Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. I want to personally express my sort of sense of sympathy for Sonia Sotomayor, who fractured her ankle yesterday on the way down to Washington from LaGuardia. Poor prospective judge for the Supreme Court. We know how Supreme Court justices are selected, right? But what about the rest of the judges in America? Well, here's a story. 1 year ago in Wisconsin, two candidates for Supreme Court judge in that state waged a $5 million election campaign. Here's some of what that $5 million bought.
District Attorney Michael Gableman has committed his life to locking up criminals to keep families safe, putting child molesters behind bars for over 100 years. Lewis Butler worked to put criminals on the street. Like Reuben Lee Mitchell, who raped an 11-year-old girl with learning disabilities. Butler found a loophole. Mitchell went on to molest another child. Can Wisconsin families feel safe with Lewis Butler on the Supreme Court?
Nasty stuff, but it was an election campaign, and in the end, candidate Gableman won the seat. But the chance that campaign money could buy something more than just attack ads, maybe like a verdict, is before the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court ruled yesterday that judges must disqualify themselves from any case involving a person who has given money to help put the judge on the bench. The Supreme Court decision was split 5-4, and it's a pretty fascinating issue all the way around. We're joined by Adam Liptak. He's the Supreme Court correspondent for our partners, New York Times. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
It seems fairly straightforward to me. If somebody gave you a campaign contribution, you'd have to recuse yourself from any case where they were a plaintiff or a defendant. Why was the court split 5-4 here?
Well, first of all, let me clarify a little bit. The court ruled that in a very extreme case, if there's really big money involved, that a judge would have to recuse himself. It did not rule about what is quite routine in 39 states around the country, which is that judges take money from lawyers and litigants who appear before them and do not disqualify themselves. The court ruled in the most extreme case that disqualification is necessary, but the practice itself will continue to be widespread, and the court emphasized in the 5-4 decision that only a very disproportionate influence here, $3 million of contributions, would require disqualification.
Well, the question is this a test, a sort of a explicit bar that the court has said, or if you want to turn it the other way, have they actually endorsed the kind of patchwork quilt system of selecting judges that we have in the United States? I want to add a voice to our conversation. Tom Phillips joins us. He's a lawyer at Baker Botts in Austin, Texas. He served as Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court from 1988 to 2004. Judge Phillips, thanks for being with us.
Surely.
Is it
in answer to your question?
Sure, go ahead.
The court is ruling, of course, only on what the United States Constitution requires. And there's nothing in the United States Constitution that the court found that said that every state had to choose its judges, like the federal system chooses judges, or in any other single way. They did find that the Constitution did not allow a judge to sit on a case where a litigant with a key interest in that case had spent $3 million trying to influence the outcome of one of the judicial elections.
So I guess the takeaway from this case, as far as we can tell right now on this 5-4 decision, is if it's $3 million worth of contributions, then definitely that is like over the bar. I'm wondering, though, Adam, if there are a couple of conflicting doctrines here. One, which is states' rights, which says there doesn't have to be uniformity in the selection of politicians and state officials from state to state. But also the court has ruled that money equals speech. And does this case come close to the territory where you're regulating campaign contributions as speech in any way?
Well, you're right that there are two conflicting things going on. The question of whether a litigant will feel treated fairly if he knows that the judge before whom he or she is appearing has taken money from the adversary is a different question from whether someone can speak. People can put on as many TV ads as they like supporting a judge, but it may be that they can't expect that judge then to go on and rule in the case. So it's possible for these two ideas to coexist quite nicely. You can say whatever you want, but you can't expect then that person to rule in your case.
Tom Phillips, do you think the system that we have for selecting judges, even though it is not a uniform system, and I'm not endorsing a uniform system, is a good one?
No, I believe that the election system does not work well currently in most states. It was first adopted back in the mid-19th century when there were no media campaigns for judge. Generally, it was word-of-mouth campaigns, and no candidate who wanted to be a judge had to go out and solicit thousands or millions of dollars from people who generally had some, at least some vague interest in the direction the court was going in order to advertise and secure one of these positions.
This is Faraya. I just wanted to ask, one of the factors that influences our government is the deep fundraising need of people, particularly who go into Congress and the Senate, and the fact that there is a huge incumbency rate that tracks with fundraising. How much time do you think it takes some of these people running for positions as judges to maintain themselves in a fundraising aspect once they are in office, or how to break the barrier? I mean, fundraising, doesn't it take away from the fundamentals of the job?
I think it does in a couple ways.
That's directed to me.
Yes, Tom.
There's a fundamental difference between a candidate for a political office like Congress and a candidate for judge. And that is that a candidate for Congress is supposed to have a platform. They make promises, and they seek support based on what they stand for. And so they go out and campaign, gather support, and then when they get in office, they're supposed to work to enact that platform. Judges are different. They don't make any pledges or promises about how they're going to rule in a case. All they bring is fairness. Now, most states, I think every state, restricts the time in which judges can raise money. But still in all, whenever you treat a judge the same way you treat other officials who have a different function in office, I think you tend to confuse within the public's mind and perhaps even the judge's mind the very different roles that different officers in a government perform.
Adam, what do you think of that system? The judges bring fairness and there are restrictions on campaign time.
Well, I've talked to judges running, say, for the Ohio Supreme Court who went to 40 fundraising events in a year. That's a lot of time off the bench. You also have to wonder whether the kind of person who's good at that, who's good at the gland handling and the fundraising, has the kind of temperament you want in a judge, which I generally associate with a more withdrawn and studious and disinterested kind of temperament.
Well, a last question to you, Tom, and maybe Adam has a follow-up here. I can't resist, knowing just the way politics is down in Texas, a lot of money down there. I'm not accusing anyone of anything in the state of Texas, but did you ever have a case where a defendant or a plaintiff were before you, which kind of caused a twinge in your stomach, knowing that they might have contributed to a campaign of you or someone close to you?
Well, yes, I was basically, as in this case, more concerned about non-lawyers, that is, parties to a case,
right,
than I was about lawyer contributions. I did put on voluntary caps on what I would accept from any source, and eventually our legislature made those caps, turned them into law. But I know that if I were a litigant in a system, I would never be completely sure that my case was based solely on justice when the other side or its attorney had given a lot of money to the judge and I hadn't. And that's the basic flaw in our system.
Adam, in the judges that you spoke with for your story, do you think they were confronted with this situation? How common is this kind of a potential conflict of interest, do you think?
Judges almost always, with only the rarest exceptions, will tell you that they're going to rule fairly. But they will also tell you that the people who give them money very often expect something in return.
So where does the case go? Is there another case that's likely to test this further, or do you think this is coming to be settled?
This now goes to the lower courts, who are going to take this quite vague standard about disproportionate influence and try to apply it to all sorts of cases. It's going to give rise to, as the dissenting judges said, lots of litigation, and we'll see whether this is a one-time ruling or something that actually has an effect on a very widespread practice.
Tom Phillips, would you agree this ruling is not the basis for a broad reform of judge selection in the United States?
No, that's really beyond the power of the Supreme Court. But for the first time, the court did recognize that there can be a constitutional implication to large campaign contributions to a judge. So right. that's a big step forward and may advance the public debate within the states.
So the takeaway is
judges should be selected.
So it's possible the Supreme Court has opened the door here. Tom Phillips, lawyer at Baker Botts in Austin, Texas, served as Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court from 1988 to 2004. Thanks, Tom. And Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent for our partners in New York Times. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.